Hello and welcome to the Emerald City Video Podcast. Today we're going to be starting our Summer of Riverdale project, where hopefully every week we are going to look at one movie that provided a title for season one of Riverdale, and then a classic teen movie that we think complements it nicely. I'm Russ Burlingame, and with me today is...
Hi, I'm Ava Fermanska.
And Ava worked for the video store a really long time. I don't think that you and I actually worked together in the same building at the same time.
No, I worked at Chimneys for about 7 years, and then worked at Emerald City, I think it was like 99 to 2001.
Yeah, and so you may be, like, I may have been replacing you when I got hired.
And this was the East Syracuse location, right?
Yeah, this was at Store One, as we call it. Although at the time, we had the Chimneys location as well, I think. I know I was there. There was a period of time where I worked at both stores. But I'm glad to. It's funny because when I was talking with Erica, who came on for the first time 2 episodes ago, we talked a lot about how we wanted to get together and do a podcast with you. And then timing-wise, it didn't work to have Erica on this week. But now that you're doing one, hopefully you'll have a good experience and we can all get together and do one.
Yeah, I would love to. I love Erica. So it would be great to catch up with her as well.
So we're talking today about River's Edge, which is one of those things I'm going to say wrong about 100 times because the Riverdale episode is called The River's Edge instead of River's Edge. And then we're also talking about a little bit about 16 Candles, and as tends to happen, like, there's kind of a main feature and a backup feature, and 16 Candles, I suspect, will be a little bit of a backup feature. Why don't you kick us off? What are your... Because you've seen... you had seen River's Edge before, and I actually watched it for the first time for the podcast. So what is your big takeaway kind of watching it again?
Well, I remember I had fond memories of River's Edge being one of those movies, you know, when people ask you to name movies that you really loved, it's one of those ones from that I always mention. It comes up on the list, and I honestly hadn't watched it in maybe 15 years. So I had this wave of nostalgia for this movie. You know, it opens up and you see the costumes on everybody, the way they look, and it's just very much like a defining weird kid movie. Like, you see them, they're the weird kids. They are grunge before grunge was a thing. And Keanu is a little baby. And so that was my first, like, oh, thank God I'm watching this movie again. I love it so much. But now as a full-fledged adult, right away, things got cringy. And, you know, it's like, it's that weird, is this movie for me? Is it made for me? It was made for me when I watched it the first time, which, just to give you a quick background, and I know you know this, but people listening to this might not. Yeah. I actually went to film school, and this film was assigned. I took a class called Teen Angst in 80s Movies. So I don't believe we watched 16 Candles, but we did watch Pretty in Pink for that syllabus. And I remember watching this movie, first time I think was in high school still, just because Chimneys had it. And then I watched it again for class, and that was maybe the last time I saw it. I might have watched it once where I brought it over to someone's house to watch it, like in college or something. And I remember really identifying with it. Like, this film is for me, like, you know, made for me, my friends, whatever. And now I was just like, okay, so right away, kind of cringy, like, setting the tone of it is we do this whole long take on a totally naked teen girl, you know, just really, really uncomfortable. But that's great filmmaking because it is there, like, that beat too long where it's no longer like, oh, you know, it's racy, we're showing a naked lady right off the bat. Like, no, this is definitely like a young teenager, probably 15 or so. And it is just a lingering shot. So there's a lot there.
I will say, too, it also has kind of the Laura Palmer thing where she's, like, purple. And so it's difficult, unless you've got a fetish, I would imagine, to really sexualize the shot beyond just the fact that, oh, there's boobs. She is not a person at this point.
And just to take it back, like, one beat, they actually open with Tim, the world's creepiest younger brother.
Yeah.
With his, like, dangling earring and, like, gross whole demeanor, which this actor is amazing because he doesn't even say anything. He's by himself on the bridge with his bike. Mm-hmm. And you can tell he's just a repulsive little toad of a person without him saying a word. Like, he has no dialogue. He is just... You see him and you're like cringing. You're like, ugh, what is this guy?
Yeah.
And so it's almost like this transference of this immediately kind of off-putting prepubescent kid and then something sketchy going on the shore of the river, and that's where you cut to John and Jamie's body. So, you know, right away I am pulled out of that, like, teen nostalgia of, like, this movie was so awesome and cool, and I feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so it was, and one thing about this movie versus 16 Candles is that it feels very modern. Like, it's timeless. It doesn't feel dated like an 80s movie. Like, 16 Candles feels dated. Like, okay, this is obviously from the 80s. This, I think if this came out right now at some art house little $2 movie theater kind of deal, I would say, okay, this was made like last year.
Yeah.
And there's a couple little things that maybe date it, but it's still very timeless.
Yeah. Even wardrobe wise, like, one of the things that's really interesting to me is that 80s wardrobe in almost all movies dates a movie so quickly. And this one, it really doesn't. Like, there's a couple of pieces of dialogue or of wardrobe that you're like, okay, that's very 80s, especially because you have two characters who are both wearing Def Leppard t-shirts.
A lot of cool t-shirt choices in this film.
Yeah, but I will say, I think you're right, like, the look of the film and the, like, there's, like, one of the things that, one of the tests that it doesn't fail very much is... This is not a film that feels like it would be demonstrably different if they had cell phones.
Yeah, definitely.
Although one weird little note about wardrobe that did kind of 80s-ify me is the prevalence of, among the non-weird kids, like, at least two other characters that weren't main characters had black vests on. And not only did it strike me as like, oh yeah, that's right, the mid-80s were when everybody was wearing vests, but also because specifically this is a Keanu Reeves movie, I just had like Ted Logan flash forwards.
Yeah, the vests are definitely not back yet, but, you know, I wouldn't put it past Forever 21 to have those in a year or two. And the thing, the wardrobe thing that I found kind of like the big... glaring thing that is not happening is Ione Skye's character Clarissa tucks her jeans into her socks.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And that is definitely not back, or maybe never will be back, because it is very odd.
But Ione Skye is also one of those, like, for me, she herself is so like late 80s, early 90s that she's like a walking time capsule.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing too is you look at the casts of this film versus 16 Candles, and Molly Ringwald and Anthony Michael Hall, they all went on to do other movies. Although Jake, I don't know what happened to that guy. I don't think he did much. He was just Jake. But they were like iconic in this very, like, I don't know, they were definitely actors that had great resumes and did a lot of stuff, continuing on till now, which, you know, Molly Ringwald is in Riverdale now. But then you've got the cast of River's Edge, and they are just like the cool Hollywood kind of went to clubs and were friends with musicians and then dated all these, like, Ione Skye dated Anthony Kiedis for a long time. So they've got this whole other layer outside of the world of the movie of, like, you're walking into this movie and you see Keanu and you see Dennis Hopper and you're just thinking, like, these were, like, the cool people. Whereas the 16 Candle people, not so much, not very cool.
The funny thing is that even though John Hughes likes to play these characters as outcasts, like, their prevalence in his films means they kind of peaked in high school, so to speak. To answer your speculation, because I couldn't remember either, Michael Scheffling, who plays Jake, you're right. He was out of Hollywood by 1991. He was in a bunch of, like, C-list stuff, and then his last couple movies were Mermaids and Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken.
Oh, well, both of those are actually pretty good, and I can't believe I don't remember him in either of those. I'm going to have to give him a rewatch.
Yeah, but, no, those
yeah,
are actually
kind of a blip.
Yeah, those are actually good, but the stuff in the middle was very much like B and C list. It's like, Let's Get Harry, Sylvester, Deadly Nightmares, Slaves of New York. so it's like stuff that I'm sure we had at the video store, but I don't think anybody ever rented.
Yeah. So let's get back to River's Edge. What was your first, I mean, watching it as your first watch, you know, in 2017, what was your reaction to the open, to the first few scenes there?
My first reaction was that, like, and this goes on for about 10 minutes before you finally start to see something that pushes you the other way. But my first reaction was, like, that, holy shit, this is a movie where nobody is likable. Eventually, you did start to get some real humanizing moments, especially for John and Matt, because, like, they're caring for, you know, his aunt and his sister and the relationship with Clarissa for Matt. But, like, the first 10 minutes or so, it's like, you see the guy who has apparently killed somebody, the kid who doesn't care, and then you're introduced to their whole circle of friends who are all just kind of terrible
jaded
to everyone around them. Yeah.
Jaded, yeah.
And it's...
And go ahead.
I was going to say, I feel like I would probably have had a similar reaction to you watching it when I was a teen, being like, oh, yeah, these are totally the outcast kids. But, like, the total, like, lack of empathy and stuff like that. I'm like, as watching it as an adult, I'm like, some of these people, I just want to, like, slap them immediately.
Yeah, and the weird thing, which I didn't, I mean, I knew it was based on real events, mm-hmm. and, you know, even going back to when I watched it for class in undergrad, I remember reading the news article about the murder that it was based on. Mm-hmm. And now I live in San Francisco and I went back and reread, you know, what the basis of the movie was. And it happened right here in the Bay Area in Milpitas. So that was kind of like a, oh, okay, this is so, it gives it an extra layer because if this was a fictional, completely just fabricated story, it would be one thing, but it was based on the fact that the news reports and everybody were so shocked that this was a real aspect of it, that these kids were not phased, that 13 people were taken to this body and nobody said anything for days. Yeah. So they had to build that in. That had to be written in as part of the focus of what happened in this event. And I think that the cast does a really great job of sort of masking that they have feelings. I mean, not all of them, obviously. Like, I don't think Tim or his friend with the nunchucks or, you know, a lot of them maybe never feel anything about the body. But I do think that you get that breakthrough with Matt. You get that breakthrough with Clarissa and Maggie when they start talking about whether they want to call it in.
Yeah.
And they go to that payphone, which obviously total 80s moment, the going to the payphone.
And the payphones are omnipresent. And what I said earlier about, like, this movie wouldn't be that much different without with cell phones, there is one, like, I think the payphones actually add something to this movie that would be lost in kind of the age of cell phones, because to me, the like that heavy use of payphones for people who aren't smart enough to really be covering their tracks, I feel like it's a sign of like an impoverished area. It feels like these people don't have phones. Which is probably
and
not
they're never
true,
home. They don't have homes in the first, like the only house, the houses that you actually enter, you see that Feck is the kind of home base for all these kind of transient kids.
Yeah. Yeah. The only one who has like a seemingly functional home is Clarissa. And honestly, like one of the things, like one of the reasons that the relationship with Clarissa kind of humanizes Matt, I think, is because she seems so much like she's on the outside edge of these people. Like, it seems like she's a fairly, like, normal person who hangs out with them for the weed.
Yeah, and they do. I mean, one thing that I really appreciated about this film, even though, you know, they do the naked body, like we talked about mm-hmm. already, and all this stuff where, you know, Lane is obviously just hounding Clarissa and Matt's interested in her and everything else. Mm-hmm. There are moments where she's talking to Maggie and they are just, they're of their own narrative. They yeah. aren't just a girlfriend or, you know, a love interest. And so I do like that aspect of this film mm-hmm. is that their role isn't simply to propel forward the narratives of the men, of the
right.
boys in this movie.
Yeah, and I will say, too, like, and to me, there's a lot of things in this movie that feel a little bit half-formed, and that might just be me as a watcher not quite grasping what they were going for, but, like, one of the things that feels like, okay, there's something here, and I'm not 100% sure what yet, but is the fact that in a movie where Feck and John both talk about the women in their lives as being disposable and having been killed because, like, well, I had to show them who's boss, Clarissa is still, like, she's a character who's clearly kind of allowing herself to be strong-armed, but A, she's aware of it. And then B, when she eventually enters into this like relationship with Matt, it's her who's essentially doing all the talking and her who's on top during sex. And I'm like, it feels to me like they're at least trying to nudge you in the direction of saying that like she has more agency than almost anybody else in this movie.
And Matt is also the one character in this narrative who has kind of bookend and like a full, more three-dimensional relationship with multiple female characters. He yeah. has a little sister that relationship is shown, him caring for his sister, trying to do that funeral for her lost doll with her, mm-hmm. and then his relationship with his mother, where he resents the mother's boyfriend. Also, my absolute favorite line in this movie is, "You motherfucker, you food eater."
Yeah.
I mean, just some really, there's gems in this
yeah,
screenplay.
That,
so
that felt like it almost felt like an ad lib, because it's like he had just had that line, like, "You're only here to fuck my mom and eat our food." And then like, I could totally see that being a weird ad lib where motherfucker was in the script and then somebody just threw in food eater because it was a callback to what they said 3 minutes ago.
Also, totally true to a teenage boy mad at his mom.
Oh, yeah.
Where you just are blurting out whatever is, like, on the forefront of your mind, and sometimes it is awkward. So, I mean, I do love that scene. It feels very real. And that's the other thing, bring this and to 16 Candles. 16 Candles is a movie that is so color by number, you know, Mad Libs, fill in the blank, teen movie. This movie is so erratic and all over the place. There is no formula.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what's going to happen next. And I feel like, you know, you look at the genre movies like rom-coms and stuff that come after the John Hughes canon, and it is so predictable. You know exactly, yeah, like, this beat is going to happen, and then we're going to have the moment where you think that this isn't going to happen for these two characters, and then, oh, they have some sort of weird thing, and they're back together. And it's just, you get strung along to the eventual end that you're prepared for. Mm-hmm. And with this movie, you don't feel that. There's a lot of anxiety and kind of, it could get so much worse for you're rooting for them. And even though they have these blank masks of, like, mm-hmm, not caring and being not likable, they are made very human. So you do kind of feel like a, to what their fate might be, because it is so unknown. And yeah, I love that about this movie, is that it's just great character building. They're not cliches. They're not paper doll characters. They're very much like weird, real, damaged people.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think speaking to both that element and also to what you were saying about some of the dialogue, the screenplay really captures, I think, like, real humanity in a way that not a lot of Hollywood screenplays do, because you're taught that, like, a good screenplay, everything kind of ties into itself. So, like, a good example, again, looking at 16 Candles, whenever there's, like, an argument or a joke, everything in it dovetails nicely, and it's got kind of that Aaron Sorkin-esque kind of, like, everybody's smart, everybody has a sense of humor, every argument is kind of well choreographed. And in this movie, you have a lot of kind of jagged edges. You have a lot of, like, people who don't quite land the punch that they think they're gonna land. And, you know, fights that end because somebody walks away or drives away. And there's something very kind of real about that, and also the fact that it is so kind of, it's unresolved in a way that most screenplays don't let it be, means that, like, you watch this movie and you're kind of raw the whole time waiting for the next thing to happen.
And I think the other thing that when we started talking about how River's Edge is not as dated, I think one of the other aspects of how it's not dated is that even though, and I made a mental note of this rewatching it, they make kind of flip references to rape a couple times.
Yeah.
Which I don't necessarily think is the same as a rape joke per se, but 16 Candles is riddled with racial stereotypes, just really, really offensive use, yeah, of, you know, words and references to sexuality, like homophobic slurs. And these things make it dated in a different way.
Yeah.
That was stuff that you would laugh into the back of your hand because, you know, it wasn't necessarily just like a taboo to have this horrible Asian stereotype character. It was totally fine. Like, that was a thing that was like a cheap laugh,
yeah,
but a valid laugh at that time. And I don't think River's Edge has any of those for me.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, the rape thing is a good example because I hadn't watched 16 Candles in a handful of years. And so when I watched it, I know you saw the little video that I did that was essentially my reaction video of, like, holy shit, I don't remember this movie being so date rapey.
Oh my God, like the Carolyn scene, and, yeah, and, you know, just it blows your mind that people in their teens, you know, 14, 15 year olds were watching this. This was a PG movie.
Yeah.
And all of this was just, you know, standard fare when there's a dance.
Yeah.
This is just what happens.
And it struck me actually really the ending of that whole thing, where Carolyn wakes up the next day and she's sober and not at all sick and hungover. And she essentially tells Brian, like, oh, I'm pretty sure that we had sex while I was unconscious, but hey, it was pretty good, so whatever. And, like, the way that that's this, like, creepy male fantasy thing. And then they had a kind of oblique reference to that towards the beginning of River's Edge, where Clarissa and Maggie were like, Maggie was going to go see the body, and Clarissa says something like, you know, they're just taking you out there so they can rape you. And Maggie says, oh, you think so? Tee-hee-hee, and then they laugh.
I thought that as gallows humor, though.
Well, and
I kind of definitely didn't think that that was, like, a pass for that kind of behavior. And it was amongst girls, so there was no guy there witnessing that exchange and seeing it as some sort of permission.
Right, and that's what I was kind of getting to slowly. But yeah, the fact that it's essentially the same, it feels to me like an inversion of the same joke. Like in 16 Candles, that's played straight, whereas in this movie it's played as gallows humor.
And I feel like there was another, the other thing that I really wanted to touch on is Feck's relationship with his doll,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I mean, obviously it was written to show his kind of mental breakdown after committing a murder.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I feel like it's some sort of illustration of this guy knew that he killed someone he loved and he should never have a relationship with another woman again because he was scared he might hurt her. And he never interacts in the entire movie with any of the female characters.
Yeah.
So he defends her, though, and he defends her honor, and he says that she's a good girl and that, you know, she would not do that. And
mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of... I think we're supposed to see Feck's story as a redemption story.
Right.
Which is a little problematic because you don't really want to forgive him for killing this woman at some point in his previous life. But that is a very nuanced part of the film where he is friendly with these kids and he really opens up to them and uses them as sort of like a therapy, like mm-hmm. getting this off his chest. And it's done in this very like careful way. And
yeah,
they could have done a lot more with it, but I feel like her, the doll floating in the river at the end is very symbolic.
Mm-hmm. I'm also like, there was actually a whole lot in the end of Feck's story that, like, and again, like, there was a lot of things in this movie that they don't spell out for you because this is not a paint-by-numbers kind of movie. But one of the things I thought was really interesting was in his kind of final confession when he's in the hospital bed and he's talking to the camera, whether or not it's a cop or who, I don't think we see. But I feel like even the why of what he did is a little bit open to interpretation because he spells out, like, I did it because there was no hope for this guy. But when he says he didn't care about her, he didn't feel anything, but I did, I was kind of like, you know, I think the implication here is he's talking about the murder victims. But it could just as easily be about the way that he treated Ellie, that John treated Ellie. Which... that's a thing that they played with Feck throughout the movie, was exactly how much of his relationship with Ellie is delusional versus not, and to what extent he kind of thinks that she's, you know, real, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you're definitely onto something with the fact that there's a lot of, in the dialogue, there is a lot of, this person might be talking about this event mm-hmm. or this character, but it's a gray area where they might actually be talking about this other thing. And that's fairly realistic to how people communicate in real life anyway.
Yeah.
And you don't get that. In 16 Candles, there's two things that the dialogue plays towards, either furthering the narrative or basically a gag,
mm-hmm.
you know? And
yeah.
There's no real moments of of vulnerability. Like there is supposed to be this buildup of Sam as this infatuated kind of fragile person who wants to be recognized, but you don't. They never give her the opportunity to be a fully formed teenage girl. She's very much just a catalyst for the narrative, for the gags, for, you know, all this stuff just kind of unfolding so we can laugh at it. I never really, I felt bad for Sam because she's kind of like a gag in her own story.
Yeah.
She's not given like primacy, even though supposedly the movie's about her.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things too where you, a good example is the actual like, okay, so everybody forgot my birthday, like element of it, where you aren't really given enough time with Sam before they land gag after gag after gag about that. Where you feel like, to me, even in my multiple viewings, I've never felt genuinely bad for her. It's like, this is a really crappy thing to happen to a person, but it feels like this is just a thing that's happening, and her reaction is more the story than the fact that it's happening, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Her extreme reaction to the way her family reacted, and then the fact that she doesn't take the opportunity to remind her mother in that first scene, like, it's very much all kind of wrapped up in these are Sam's kind of issues. And so you never get a real sense for who she is outside of the plot of this specific, like, you know, that's one of the things that I think really makes 16 Candles less successful as a character sketch than, you know, The Breakfast Club, where it's like everything happens in the span of 4 hours or whatever it is in The Breakfast Club, but you also know so much more about these characters. It's like you spend probably 60 minutes of a 90-minute movie with Sam, and I still don't really know anything about her that didn't happen in that 60 minutes.
And nothing she does is surprising. Mm-hmm. I mean, the character in all the John Hughes movies that I think I want her to be, that she never is Ferris Bueller's sister. You know, she's also the girl that everyone forgets, and she's angry because everyone cares about her brother. But she gets to be angry. She gets to have a meltdown and rebel and do all this stuff. And Sam just kind of does all the stuff that's expected of her. I mean, even to the point where when, you know, she gives up her underwear, it's like, why would she make that choice? That's never justified. Like, they don't set up a justification for her to be like, all right, you know, fine, we'll do this. Like, it just, it's not earned. And and that, I keep coming back to that thought with 16 Candles, is all the motivation and the action of all these characters is never earned.
Yeah.
I don't think Ted earns the stuff he gets to do. He's just like floating through his written part, and it just, that's the next thing that's going to happen. So of course it's going to happen.
Yeah. It's, I remember, and again, like, I, the last time I watched these was probably around 2002, because I feel like I did a John Hughes binge right after Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, because they had the whole John Hughes thread that had started in Chasing Amy and run all the way through Strike Back. So it's been a really long time, and I remembered, like, after Breakfast Club, which I have watched relatively recently, I remembered 16 Candles being kind of the one that I liked the best as a, like, just a young person watching these for comedy. Like, as somebody who's a little bit older and who, like, expects a little bit more out of my movies now, I kind of feel like, man, I have to rewatch his canon to see if most of it is crap, or if it's just that, like, I attached myself to one that was really not as strong as I remembered, like, as a young person, because the jokes were there, you know?
Yeah, and I think This is going to maybe be a little harsh, and maybe I'm kind of taking it to a level that it's not at, but you look at like a lot of the stuff that's happening socially and politically now, and the whole like men's rights activist kind of fedora wearing vaping bro kind of beta male, whatever they're called.
Yeah.
This is fodder for that mindset. The whole idea of the friend zone,
yeah,
and, you know, all that. This is sort of where those guys might have planted the seeds when they were like 12 or 13 or 14. And they, and a lot of Hughes's films do this, you know, where like you put in the work and mm-hmm. you did all the right things. And this girl who's your quote unquote friend still doesn't want to get with you. And then there's just like this bubbling up of anger and resentment yeah. Of that, like, this person is not worthwhile in your life as just a platonic friend.
Yeah.
And it's, there's a permissiveness to that understanding of a teenage girl in your life. And, mm-hmm. and it doesn't seem as innocent now watching this at 38 as it did when maybe I watched it when I was 20 or 22, where that was like, well, yeah, but that's just how it is. And now it's like, no, you know what? It shouldn't be, and it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, and I'm curious too whether, I'm curious whether watching it now as, you know, an 18-year-old would be different than watching it, you know, pre-2000 as an 18-year-old. Because I feel like there's, I mean, a good example, you use the friend zone thing. And I remember watching that movie, Just Friends, the Ryan Reynolds thing.
Oh, yeah.
And just, like, watching that whenever it came out, like 2003 or something. And as I'm watching it, it was a weird, weird movie. Because it was actually, like, there were a lot of jokes that landed. The characters were, by and large, pretty likable. But the premise was so offensive that, like, just watching it, you're, like, sitting there going, like, why are all these talented actors and, like, a screenwriter who clearly, like, understands how to write humans, like, why are they all attached to this premise that's so awful? And so I kind of wonder if this is a movie that it's about our age and our development that makes it a little bit more or if, you know, if it came out now, if it would be perceived that way out of the gate.
Well, the thing that, and you know, we're tying this kind of into Riverdale in a sort of way, and then we could just talk about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the teen relationships in that show, I feel like they do a really great job of turning that on its head and shutting it down. And, you know, even though I, as someone who has kind of read the Archie stories
mm-hmm.
pre-Riverdale, I was a little annoyed that Jughead is, like, all of a sudden a guy who dates girls, because that's not real Jughead. He should just be eating burgers, you know? But I do like the way that romantic relationships are handled on that show, and the way they are talked about, and the way that characters are called out for things, or, you know, you get the setup of Betty and Veronica being forced against each other for the affections of Archie at the beginning, and that's immediately dispelled. Like, no, we're going to be friends, and Archie's a weirdo who we're friends with, but look at him, he's a mess. Like, it's sort of handled all of that stereotypical heteronormative teenage romantic intrigue is turned on its head right away, and I do appreciate that about how they handle. I mean, there was the weird stuff with Grundy, because that's not, like, maybe they went a little too far with being permissive about taboo stuff, because that made me feel a little cringy.
It was a weird, it's like a CW thing, because if you remember, Greg Berlanti, who's in Riverdale, was actually one of the executive producers on Dawson's Creek, where that thing happened in the first season. And so, I feel like that's just one of those things that they like somewhere along the line, somebody has thought like, this is a plot driver. Like, this is a thing that we can kick action off with. And it's definitely
weird. It was ended very strangely. I feel like maybe somebody came back to them and said like, pull the plug on this relationship because it's sketchy. And then they just like had her leave town. And there was no other, like, they do this whole thing where they're like, okay, now we're investigating what happened that day. And there's a witness that's missing from, yeah. She was here. And they're like, oh, well, has anyone followed up with Grundy? No, she's just out of the show now.
Yeah.
As an attorney, I felt like a little bit betrayed by their investigative efforts. But, there's only so much that you can demand from the show.
Yeah. A really weird thing to pull us all the way back, because this is a note that I took that I actually thought that you might have an interesting thing to say about. I mentioned the Iron Maiden t-shirts. You have this weird thing where at one point in the same, like, I can't remember if they were in the same scene or if it was just in the same 5 minutes, but I took these notes. John's Iron Maiden t-shirt and Timmy's Iron Maiden t-shirt feels like intentional mirroring. Like, this is who Timmy's going to be.
No, Timmy's got a Def Leppard shirt.
It was the same band. It was Def Leppard. I misremembered.
Yeah. Because he definitely wears an Iron Maiden t-shirt, which is weird because it's either inside out or it's printed backwards.
Yeah, it's very, yeah.
He also wears a Def Leppard t-shirt.
But I remember, like, that was my thing, was, like, is this supposed to be mirroring that, like, John is this kid's potential future? And then, as I was, like, taking my note, I made the next, like, logical leap of, like, if you're going to go that way, does that make Feck John's potential future because blah, 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 blah? And then as I was writing that note, Feck literally overtly says to John, like, that, you're going to end up like me someday. And I'm just like, never mind, they answered that one.
I have to say, especially in the light of, what American reality is in 2017 and how scary and depressing and awful a lot of that is, because we had thought, like, oh, we're moving in this, like, really great progressive direction and,
Yeah.
And all of that kind of got pulled out from under us. I was looking at all these characters through this new lens of us as teenagers and then in college and then, just moving up through our 30s, kind of hoping that all the little steps that maybe weren't happening fast enough, but they were going in the right direction. And all of a sudden, we are just shoved back into the Reagan era. Like, it's insane how quickly that happened. Mm-hmm. And it looks like the generations in this film sort of represent that. Like, there's a lot of these kids were given up on by their parents. And so their parents are either barely checking in on them, like Clarissa's mom, she walks in the house, she makes sure it is Clarissa, okay, it is Clarissa, Clarissa's alive, good, like, yeah. That's the extent of their relationship. Or you see Matt and Tim's mom, and she does obviously care about them and their sister, but she's so busy, and she's really focused on this new relationship with this guy who's just living at their house and sleeping all day, and he's her main concern. So I look at Feck as this, and obviously Dennis Hopper has the mythology of being the outlaw biker, and yeah. That's his character, and that's been his character in so many movies and just basically in real life, of this like acid casualty dropout guy. And I think that in the 80s there was a lot of critique of that, of like, there was the Summer of Love in the 60s, and then there was these biker people who maybe were the first people who did drugs like meth, which obviously at some point we do need to talk about Crispin Glover's whatever the fuck he is, because he is the ultimate tweaker. Like, that is all I think when I see this character, which was amazing. I mean, his performance is so good in this.
Yeah.
But you look at that Dennis Hopper Feck generation, and then you kind of feel like Tim is the next wave and how he's going to be even worse. Like, he has less humanity. Like, at least Matt has some humanity.
Right.
He just hides. He masks it. He wears the, skull denim vest yeah. over the leather jacket thing. But underneath that, he's a person who cares about his friends and doing the right thing and his mom and his little sister. Tim maybe doesn't have any of that. You know, yeah. he's about to, like, kill his brother for a slight, for, like, we had a fight, like brothers do, so I'm going to mm-hmm. shoot him. So I definitely feel like there's that kind of, these characters represent what's wrong with this generation, mm-hmm. you know? And it's kind of, like, supposed to be one of those cautionary tales. Like, if we keep letting it slip, this is where we're heading.
And it's also interesting because stories that do that with Generation X tend to mythologize the, like, the 60s counterculture. And this movie actively and aggressively does not do that, because you have the teacher who mythologizes 60s counterculture, and everything he says right up until the point where he snaps at the nerd kid and tells him to shut the hell up, like, almost everything he says in this film is clearly meant to be laughed at.
Yeah. He's played for comic relief in that way. Mm-hmm. Like, haha, you guys thought this was the way to, like, talk about all these issues. Obviously, it's not working.
Yeah. And so it's interesting because I kind of feel like it, in a film where it could very easily be a film made by, you know, somebody who grew up in the 60s and basically old man shouting at cloud, I feel like it's basically saying every generation of, like, functional adults right now are all broken.
Yeah, and I think that Clarissa's relationship with the teacher is really well done, because it gets turned on its head at some point, at least for me it did, where first half of the film, you're thinking it's the stereotypical teenage girl in love with her teacher, just has a big crush on him. And then you see him, and he's not really crush-worthy. He's kind of a dork. And then you see what he's talking about, and it's like, oh, I get it. She's not in love with her teacher. She is into listening to what he's saying, his ideology, his like take on how to proceed in society and be cynical and critical of it. But then when something really bad happens and the shit goes down in Clarissa's life and her friend is murdered, she sees through all of that. And that's when she's just like, you know what? This is not a real thing. Matt is a real person in my life.
Yeah.
And she goes and pursues Matt.
Yeah. And it's that was actually one of the things that I really liked in the film, was the way that they dealt with. And it's funny because as the scene started, before it was clear that he was falling apart, when the teacher was, like, just putting kids on the spot, trying to get them to talk about their peer, like, the note, and again, I was, like, taking notes as I'm doing this, and, like, the note that I was taking was essentially, man, this is such a terrible idea, because it flies in the face of, like, everything that we've done in the 20 years since with, like, school shootings and all these other tragedies, where there is a way that you go about it. Like, you try to minimize, like, placing blame on you know, anybody. And as I'm taking this note, like, the movie then makes my note overt by having him have his little meltdown and start essentially pointing fingers and yelling at people.
And it's very true to form, because that teacher is a boomer, and the boomers love to blame everyone younger than them for their own. It's not like, yeah, we bankrupted you, we had all these, like, cheap tuition, cheap mortgages, and you kids, you're not bootstrapping enough, and that's why you're failing. I mean, that's very true to actual societal progress and how these generations interact. So I think they did an excellent job in kind of, like, foreshadowing how things were going to play out.
Yeah. One thing that's also interesting in terms of foreshadowing, like, I feel like this movie, and again, like, having not seen it until now, I had no context for this, but one of the things I was thinking was that this movie feels very much like, a direct, ancestor of Tarantino. Like, it takes a lot of the kind of over-the-top, larger-than-life characters/caricatures that were common in 80s films, but once you kind of strip some of those kind of tropey elements of the characters away, it very much feels like the Tarantino kind of school of filmmaking, where it's like you're going to go into this really dark place and try to make some sense of it by humanizing the people inside. And what's interesting, you know, I had this thought, and I had tweeted, you saw the tweet that I made last night that basically said, you know, this is a really unsettling film because in spite of some great performances, like, the worldview is so bleak. The first response I got to that was Mark Russell, who is he's the writer on Flintstones comic books right now. And if you haven't read them or don't know, the Flintstones comics are incredibly seditious right now. Mark is doing this, like, anti-capitalist riff on Bedrock.
And all right, so, I need to check this out then, because that sounds right up my alley.
Yeah, it's crazy. I'll send you a copy of the first trade, because it's a ton of fun. But Mark, like, seconds after I tweeted it, responded, in many ways, that film heralds the arrival of Generation X and the latchkey kid politics of abandonment. And so that comment kind of tied into my thinking of, like, yeah, it kind of feels like it's a direct precursor to this wave of movies that wouldn't come for another 10 years. It's so strange, because the fact that it doesn't feel dated, I had to kind of keep reminding myself that this movie came before a lot of things. It's like, not only did this movie predate 16 Candles, and it predated, you know, Bill and Ted and Say Anything, and so these are actors who at that point people didn't really have an expectation for. But it predates a lot of movies that would feel like its natural kind of siblings by a good chunk of time.
I think it definitely is a standalone, though. And that's what I mean, all of my favorite films, and I don't know if you had, like, not to, let's bring this back to Emerald City, because this is, like, kind of the topic of your podcast. One issue I always had working at video stores is the categorizing. So, you know, you had some things that were obviously just comedy. You put them up in the comedy section. That's where they lived. You had some things that were obviously just going to go in sci-fi, and you got some stuff that's just going to go in horror. I love a movie that you have to stand in the middle of the store for a second and be like, I wish we had this just chronological and by director's last name alphabetically, because those are the movies that are the best. The ones that have some really just great laughs. And River's Edge has a few of those. But then at the same time, there is something just so horrific about it. So, you know, your first gut is like, I'm going to throw this up in the horror section. But then it's like, well, it's kind of a cult movie. But, like, it, you know, so you're just kind of thinking about it, like, what is this film? And that's part of why it's not only just timeless, as in if it came out in 2017, I wouldn't blink an eye. I'd be like, all right, well, maybe it's just a period piece made now about that year. Totally makes sense. Totally legit. Or, you know, could even just take out the payphones and it would still hold water. Like, kids still probably tell each other, like, go grab some money out of your house for gas for driving around today. Like, that still happens. So there's parts of this film, I would even say it's kind of a, it wouldn't even, I wouldn't say that it is like a Tarantino movie, because it doesn't even fall into that category of, to me, Quentin Tarantino movie is like a graphic novel turned into cinema. Like, it's very like panel by panel by panel. And I picture his storyboards just being a graphic novel with like red splatter for blood and primary color outfits. And all this stuff is just very like genre in of itself. And I mean, he steals and borrows with the best of them. So there's a ton of other stuff that he just like throws in the blender, but it's definitely like these characters live in a comic book. And River's Edge is just too nuanced and black and white and not, like, and it's a product of its budget, and I can tell that, you know, if they had Universal as, like 16 Candles, you look at the budget comparison. They had asked for $1 million. It ended up being $1.7 million for the budget compared to $7 million for 16 Candles, which 16 Candles does not warrant that budget. They don't have any kind of, like, explosions or crazy sets or, you know, it's
mostly, I think, because they broke so much shit, because they had to break all the stuff at Jake's house and then they had to total the car.
and paying these kids who at that point probably, you know, demanded a bigger paycheck, but you look at what River's Edge did, and I think that with the sparsity of what was available to them, it's just so beautiful. Mm-hmm. The way it's shot is so beautiful. You look at the locations, and they're pretty haunting, and just, I think they did a really great job of making it seem very much a world that they've created that is not a genre world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would just put it in its own little category.
I think one of the things that kind of speaks to what you're saying is, you know, we talked about the dialogue and how the dialogue feels real because everybody isn't on script, so to speak. But I also think, in terms of, like, low-budget filmmaking, one of the things that probably came out of that is this notion that you don't always have the lens that you'd expect for shots. Like, there was never a point where it was clear that the body in the river at the end was Ellie, except that now I blanked on his name. Keanu Reeves.
Matt,
thank you. I wanted to call him Tim, and I'm like, no. but except that Matt was sure, and you trust his judgment because it makes sense with the context that you have. And I kind of feel like there was a handful of shots like that that make you really feel like you're there with them, because you don't get the better shot. Like, you don't have the better lens showing you exactly what it is that you would see in a $5 million movie. Like, you have the shot that they have, and that's essentially what the characters are seeing and experiencing. And that's one of those weird, like, very, very understated pieces of filmmaking that I think works really effectively for the movie, because it doesn't seem like they're making a decision until you and I are having this conversation, and it's like, you know, I bet that was a decision that they made.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the performances, you know, especially Crispin Glover as Lane, like you were talking about ad-libbing lines and everything, it's like, this is the take we've got, and we've got to love what we have. We're not going to polish it. And it, a lot of how I talk and think about film and television is very similar to how I feel about music. And you've got a lot of bands that are very, very talented musicians and songwriters, but they go in the studio and they just polish out any personality that may exist in the music that they made. And they just, you know, kind of put in too many tracks.
Yeah.
And then it just becomes this piece of fluff, this kind of pop song. And that is sort of what happens to 16 Candles. If it was a kind of less polished, less on the nose, you know, bow on top of the present kind of piece of filmmaking, maybe it would be more compelling. I mean, it's got all these problematic things, like the rapiness, the homophobia, the racism. There's a lot of stuff there to unpack.
Yeah.
But on top of all of that, it just, everyone's wearing the, like, 80s uniforms, and it just, it's so airbrushed and glossy, and it's hard to even jump, like, you can't see yourself floating into that world and being there in a lot of ways because it's so polished.
Mm-hmm.
Like these people do not walk out of a scene and go on with a believable life
right.
that you can follow.
Yeah, and it's funny, I think the least believable element of River's Edge is probably the fact that they all got to the funeral. Like, I feel like half of these people
totally.
Would be in custody. And I understand, like, the filmmaking necessity of it. And I also can kind of rationalize it as, like, well, you know, half of them, there would be nothing that you could prove, especially if they decided to cover for each other. But it is, like, it's that's the only, like, that kind of feels like the least believable thing about the film. And considering that you needed it to make the ending of the film work, that actually is more of a positive than a negative, because it's like, okay, and the least believable thing is a technicality.
And, you know, as an attorney now, a lot of things that I would have let slide and enjoyed before this part of my life, that was definitely something that I thought about. Like, the fact that these kids are also all poor. Like, it's very obvious that none of these kids have any money. There's no Jake. There's no one who has, like, the house and the Rolls Royce. None of them would be able to afford representation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe if they all, like, if Matt and Tim were rich kids, then they'd be out on Dylan at the funeral. But, yeah, totally. These are things that I think they just had to let go because it needed to be there. This needed to be there.
Yeah.
I also kind of got that feeling that the community that they lived in was very isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, maybe the police were just at the funeral too. So why not let them be there?
Yeah.
Because we're all going to be there.
Yeah,
you know, this is supposed to be one of those things that rocks the community.
Exactly.
So maybe they're all.
And it's a pre-digital age, and it's a small town, and I can, like, some part of my brain can almost kind of be like, well, once the quote-unquote real bad guys are caught, maybe the cops go easy on people who just lost somebody, although that doesn't really square with the investigator who was berating Matt about not being appropriately upset.
Yeah, that was one of those things where they dipped their toe into
mm-hmm.
being a police crime drama,
yeah.
But it wasn't the heart of the movie. So
no.
It was like, and you know what? The other movie that this film kind of falls into a mini category for me is Repo Man.
Yeah.
You know, like, also a film that no real likable characters, total period piece slash defines, you know, defies a time.
Mm-hmm.
And the characters are not likable and not relatable, but there's also this, like, surreal bigger thing. I mean, obviously, River's Edge does not have aliens or anything like that in it, but it's got the same feel. It's got the same, like, soundtrack type, like, this film's got, I mean, I'm talking about River's Edge, not
right.
Repo Man now, but you've got the Wipers and Slayer on the soundtrack, and I feel like so many kids probably watched this and got into that kind of music and, you know, felt like it was an identity building piece.
Mm-hmm.
And Repo Man sort of does the same thing. It's just these, like, social outcast freaks and their stories. And so you can't get too real because you're giving these people, like, a space to be where you can just kind of hang out with them and learn about their lives. And they wrap up the narrative, I think, in a satisfying way. I didn't, at the end of the movie, I didn't feel like there was anything that they didn't touch on or they didn't wrap up that was
really
missing
to
me.
Yeah. I also think that you needed the funeral to continue the kind of conversation that had been had through the whole movie about whether or not they were ever going to come to the point where they felt the emotions that they felt like they needed to have felt. You know, I thought that the conversation about an open casket combined with the procession of our, like, our quote-unquote heroes walking up and actually seeing her one more time was, even though we didn't get a conclusive anything on it because there was no dialogue and it just cuts to black, I felt like there was, at least for me, my brain was going the whole time that they were in the funeral because that was a thing that they had already kind of established earlier in the film. And I feel like if you don't have one final whatever it was, be it a conversation, be it a... But I think that this is better than a conversation because if you go into conversation, you run that risk of making it way too overt and then kind of talking down to your audience. So I felt like that there wasn't anything that was left dangling. And I thought that even though we're kind of saying like, haha, the funeral thing doesn't make a lot of sense, the funeral thing kind of was responsible for why there was nothing left dangling.
Yeah, and I mean, there's this the symbolism also of the open casket, meaning we are going to see Jamie's face and all these kids letting their guard down and taking off their, like, expressionless masks. It was this sort of nice, very subtle but symbolic way of ending it, where at the end of the day, these were all kids, and while they seemed like monsters at different points in time throughout this film, at the end you just see their humanity one last time, and that's what you're left with.
I was going to say, except for Lane, who's kind of notably absent, considering that he, like, the discussion of how far he was willing to go to dehumanize her in order to keep the gang together was such a big kind of part of the narrative.
Lane is such a cipher in this whole film because his portrayal by Crispin Glover is just really amazing, and he reminds me of kind of Amadeus in that film, where he is just over the top, like, talking on a different plane than any of these other, like, normal human beings who are just interacting with each other in real time. He is, like, somewhere else. He is in his own world with his own understanding of events, of what these people are to him and to each other. And it never really... it never really gels. Like, there's never a point where you get Lane. He's always the total outsider.
The weird thing is, I kind of felt like I got him at a lot of points during the film because, and this is going to sound really terrible considering what a dangerous lunatic the character is, but he really reminds me of my brother. I have two younger brothers. The middle one is... he was a juvenile delinquent. He's a good guy now. When we were kids, one of the things that really struck home with me was that his sense of loyalty was kind of crafted by people who had vested interests. And so this notion of, like, the worst thing that you can possibly do is, like, involve the cops and break up the gang. It felt very much like the whole operating logic that Lane had going for the first two-thirds of the movie. It really reminded me of, like, I could 100% see my brother, like, doing this in this situation when he was 18.
Yeah, and one thing that I think was his purpose in this movie is, you look at it, it's 86, and the things that are happening politically is you get the war on drugs, which, you know, all these people are stoned. I found it really interesting that Matt very nonchalantly shares weed with his mother.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's all that happening. And then the other thing, too, is in 1986, there would have been a lot of media and like hysteria around gangs. And while it was like the stereotypical black gangs that were talked about, you know, on Time magazine and on the news and stuff, this is, I think, probably addressing that. Like, if you're talking about society's ills, quote unquote, then Lane is also probably representing like the gang mentality, the no snitching, don't trust the police, don't trust authority. And in a way, you know, there's a lot to be said about there's some good in gangs, and there you shouldn't always trust the police and you shouldn't always trust authority. And a lot of people have been totally marginalized and abandoned by authority. So I get that. But they never, they make Lane very compelling as a symbol, but not so much as an individual.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, it's funny because when, again, comparing it to 16 Candles a little bit, 16 Candles is a movie that's just full of archetypes and no real characters. Whereas this movie is a whole movie that's full of characters, and then you have this one kind of archetype who really stands out because he's so far outside of the norm of everybody else in the movie.
And I think he's also maybe... It's interesting because our bad guy, you know, is supposed to be John, who kills Jamie, but he's humanized. You know, you see him in his house with his grandmother, and you can tell he's doing some probably, like, hard emotional labor there, like, reading Dr. Seuss to her, so you get kind of an insight of, like, where she's at and what he has to do and, like, his coping skills. Lane is not the villain, necessarily, but he's never given an opportunity of redemption. Like, he fails us and every time that he, you know, kicking Clarissa out of his car and then, you know, running off and like just never having that moment where it's like, all right, I gotta face the facts here.
Yeah.
So his absence at the end is kind of telling.
I also think too, one of the interesting elements of it is that his whole kind of motivation throughout the entire movie is that he's not going to let this happen to John, you know? And the way that it's phrased and the way that it very much still feels like a very, even though it sounds selfless and he wants it to sound selfless, like it's still very much a self-centered act because it's like, well, they're not going to do this to my boy. But beyond that, he fails even at that, because ultimately, like, at the time when John is off being killed by the way, the person who you left him with, you're getting high behind the wheel and passing out. And so it's like, even in the world of, like, he does all these terrible things, but the thing that in his mind is what's redeeming him is being there for his friend. And even that he fucks up.
Yeah, and you know, as a lot of these teen movies are often referred to as coming of age stories, and that I think is maybe his failure, is he doesn't come of age. Like, all these other kids grow up because of this incident, and he's also, I think, the character who looks the oldest, and I might just be that Crispin Glover was the oldest.
Yeah, and person. I mean, Crispin Glover and Ione Skye both basically looked exactly the same for about 12 years. And so it's hard to get a bead on their age in this movie because it's like they look the same as they did in Back to the Future and Say Anything. So every so often it would be like I'd look at them and be like, because I did have that moment of like it was 12 minutes in or whatever when I realized like, oh, these guys are high school kids.
Yeah, and actually, I just did a real quick Google, and Crispin Glover and Keanu Reeves are the exact same age. So maybe it's just that Crispin Glover had that more mature look when he was a teenager. And, you know, I think that there's, like, a part of me that always gets a little cynical, because you kind of hear about how, Luke Perry was like in his 30s on 90210 or whatever. So I'm always like, I don't know, maybe he wasn't a teenager playing this. Yeah. Yeah. And that is also a weird thing on the rewatch is that, you know, seeing these people at 22, they felt like my contemporaries. And then taking a really long break from watching it and then returning to it now, everyone looks like a kid.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a weird thing. Like, you get that kind of time capsule aspect to it. Even though it's not dated, I feel old watching it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it kind of speaking to what you said really early on, that's helped along by the fact that almost everybody in this movie has continued to work. So, like, we know what Keanu Reeves looks like now. And we know what, you know, so there's that element of like, yeah, it's, you look back at it and you're like, oh, I remember when these guys were my age and now they're 50.
Yeah. And I think especially compared to 16 Candles with their ages, there's a vulnerability that you get on both movies on, you know, that these kids definitely, and that it just, honestly, I think it might just be that when Anthony Michael Hall pops up in other movies later, and then there was like that TV show he did in the 90s.
Dead Zone?
Where all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, I cannot even believe that that's this person. Because he, in my mind, honestly, though, he's always just going to be Rusty.
Yeah.
So he's always going to be, like, 12. But, no, it's just a weird thing that we grew up with these human beings we don't know.
Well, like, when he showed up in Community, Anthony Michael Hall showed up in Community, it was so funny because his character was very much like, to just go to the John Hughes kind of canon for our archetypes, he was very much Judd Nelson, not Anthony Michael Hall, because he has blossomed into a dude who looks like he can bench press you.
Yeah.
And so it's always interesting because he's hard to place sometimes. Like, Molly isn't because of the hair.
Although she definitely looked different when you have the Molly Ringwald reveal on Riverdale, she looked a lot different than I would have expected her to look. I mean, one day we'll have to like do a separate podcast where we do a more in-depth discussion of Riverdale, because I think you're doing a great job with that, and I love. There's so many weird things, like, why are there so many redheads in that town?
I know.
It is out of control.
What we can do is we can do that on the, because there is an episode of this, of the Summer of Riverdale thing, where we will have to take a look at To Riverdale and Back Again, the 1990 Archie TV movie.
Ooh.
And first of all, it's mind-blowingly awful. But,
well, I would have expected as much because I've never heard of it. That's why I'm intrigued.
But that would be a good opportunity because I don't think that people will, and in terms of on a filmmaking level, I don't think there'll be much to say about like a bad TV movie from 1990. So that probably would be the best opportunity for us to actually like talk a little bit of Riverdale. And To Riverdale and Back Again is episode 11 of the series.
Awesome.
So by then, you know, by the time it's 10 weeks from now and we're doing the To Riverdale and Back Again episode, you definitely will be done watching Riverdale. And so I won't spoil anything.
Okay, awesome.
But that's a big thing that I wanted to do was to make this kind of accessible to people who haven't seen that show, but also accessible / attractive to people who listen to me on Archie Digest so that new people can find the Emerald City video show.
Yeah, which I want to be on more because this has been awesome.
Well, and that's, I mean, I also, like, one of the things that we really wanted to do with the show, and this is, like, a high-minded mission statement for a show that, you know, 100 people listen to, but is this idea that in the absence of video stores, what you've got now is, like, algorithms. And then a whole, like crapload of internet critics who, you know, you're basically getting one guy doing his videos, and if you find the guy who you like, great. But one of the ideas of the Emerald City thing is that, like, at video stores you had a variety of opinions, and you could find, like, the person working at the store whose opinion you trusted.
Yeah, definitely. And, I mean, I was talking to my husband about this actually just the other night, and there's two things. Well, first, again, I'm going to parallel this to music. My husband's got about, I would say, 2,000 records, maybe 3 if you count 7 inches. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about how, like, when you had the physical video cassette and even DVDs later or records, you would get that physical thing and you would have to go through the physical, like, steps of walking over to the player and putting the thing in.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would have the one and then you'd be done with it, because it was the one you brought home.
Yeah.
And when you wouldn't do the thing where you sat in front of Netflix or Amazon Prime or whatever and just scrolled and scrolled. And, like, the story that I told him the other night was when I first got a job out of Emerald City, I had gotten, Rita offered me the management job because I was just going to move straight to New York City, like, mm-hmm. everyone does when they graduate. And she was like, no, I'm going to give you salary and you can just have a real job for the time that you're looking. And then you can take a job that you feel happy with. You're not just
right.
kind of going out into this black hole of your future. And I ended up getting a job at a TV station in Kingston and moving to Kingston, where I knew nobody, like, had no friends, no family, not even acquaintances, because I worked graveyard.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't even really make friends at the station for a while. And one of my first acts at, like, 21 or 22 or whatever of independence was going to the local independent video store there and joining as a member. And for the first time since I was 15, which is, like, before that I wasn't doing this anyway, I had to pick out movies that I was going to pay for.
Yeah.
You know that feeling, like, oh, I mean, I have to pay money for these, so
yeah.
It can't be whatever. And then on top of that, I wasn't going to watch them with anyone. And I was always the person who would pick the movie to match the situation. Like, oh, I was going over to Steve's house, so Steve likes these kind of movies. Or I'm going to watch this movie with my mom. Or I'm going to, you know, be showing up at this person's house. So I would pick the movie that was going to work for that particular setting.
Yeah.
And for the first time in my life, I had to pick a movie that I was just going to watch by myself in my apartment and that I invested the, like, $1.50 for.
Yeah.
Or whatever. So it was like this really crazy, you know, I didn't even know what I wanted to watch. I didn't know what kind of movies I liked. You know, it was like facing that reality of I don't even know what I want. And there was no algorithms. And not like, because you liked A, B, and C, you might like X.
Yeah.
Like, that was never done for me. And because I had to, like, get past that, I am now extremely picky. And I would go so far as to say I'm kind of an asshole about what I like. And a lot of people assume because of, like, I guess how I dress or other stuff that I like the context of my personality, that I'm into certain things. And I will just, like, shut them down and be like, no, I don't want to talk to you about this. I've never watched any of those movies. I've never read the source material. I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care about that thing. And they're, like, shocked. Like, oh my God, how could you not like this and this? And I'm like, you know, there's only so many hours in the day, and I'm just going to watch this stuff over here, and that stuff is allowed to exist, but I'm never going to care about it. Obviously, like, you're a parent too, so a lot of this stuff is probably going to change a little.
Oh, yeah.
Once my kid starts having opinions about what she wants to watch and listen to and read. I'm assuming I will experience the Harry Potter universe for the first time when she's, like, 7 or 6, because I dipped my toe in, and I was like, yeah, not for me.
Yeah. And for me, my wife likes it a lot, so I've now seen them all. But I saw them after the whole franchise was done, and she wanted to rewatch because I had a similar, like, I didn't dislike them, but we watched the first one at Emerald City, and you know, it was always on the TV because it was PG and it was a new release.
Yep.
And then,
The curse of the new release that's PG.
yeah, exactly. Like, ask me as a, what was I when I was working there? 25-year-old male, how many times I watched 13 Going on 30?
Mine was Bring It On. We watched Bring It On a ton.
Yeah, that timing wise, I could see that. I actually bought, weird coincidence, I bought the Bring It On movie poster from Emerald City Video for a friend of mine who is a cheerleading coach.
I think Bring It On, I would do a podcast about Bring It On because I'm very pro Bring It On. I don't like teen movies, but I love that movie. And I love, well, I mean, I'm not going to say I don't like it with like a wide swath, but like the
Right.
majority of teen movies are pretty dumb. I loved Bring It On. I also would do a podcast about Josie and the Pussycats, another unsung Riverdale tie-in.
Well, let me tell you, this podcast exists because of that movie.
Awesome.
What happened was, like, I had enjoyed it when it came out, but I hadn't put much thought into it in about 10 years. And so I rewatched this film, and I was like, "Holy crap! This is so much better than I thought it was." But our first Emerald City Video podcast ever was four 30-something-year-old dudes talking about Josie and the Pussycats and the then new Star Wars movie.
See, I really wish I had jumped in on this whole thing, you know, from the get-go, because, and I have to go back and re-listen to everything, because I've only done like, you know, bits and pieces. I have to go in and just like chronologically
I'm
tackle them
such
all.
a I always warn people, like, I have weird tastes and not always good tastes. And so there will be episodes where I passionately defend movies that everybody hates. And that's just a thing that happens, and it's kind of like, well, a good example is, like, for me as a comic book nerd, everybody assumes that I'm gonna love all the superhero movies. And that, generally speaking, is not true. By and large, I think they're fine, but there's only a small handful of them that I really enjoy.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I just, and oftentimes the movie does for me like a disservice to the comic, or maybe it's a thing that should happen, but it's an unfun thing to
Yeah.
have happen, where like Watchmen made me just kind of remember that maybe Watchmen wasn't that great, and maybe my memories of it being a good read. We're like, no, I guess maybe it was that problematic. And now I, you know, all those like thoughts of it being a good piece of work, something that maybe I would read again. No, not going to. Because that movie, I feel like at first I was like, oh, that was schlocky. And then I'm like, no, you know what? Maybe that's just what Watchmen was.
I think there's a lot of, I mean, that's the funny thing is that the two major criticisms of Watchmen, and granted, there were a lot of criticisms of that movie, but the two major ones that I saw were basically people who said Zack Snyder ruined this great piece of American literature because he wasn't true enough to it, and he took all these liberties and he Zack Snydered it all over the place. And then the people who said the reason this was not a compelling movie in the way that Snyder's Dawn of the Dead or 300 was because he was hamstrung by being too loyal to the comic. And I think that the reason that those two things are the criticisms you hear is because he was very true to the comic, and the comic isn't as good as people remember.
Yeah.
So they have mythologized it, and then when they see that it's not amazing, they kind of blame Snyder.
And you know, I was bringing it back to our topic at
Yeah.
hand. I was definitely prepared to go into River's Edge feeling that way and being disappointed. Like I kind of had to like bolster myself. Like you're probably going to be disappointed. And I was pleasantly not disappointed.
Yeah, and that's I had kind of like I had no expectations of River's Edge, but I had the similar thing with 16 Candles, where it was like I had no kind of expectation or awareness that you could like that a critical viewing of 16 candles was going to kind of ruin it for me. But like watching it with a critical eye and watching it like in the headspace that I am now and in the kind of sociological space that we are now as a culture, I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't know that I'll ever want to watch this again until and unless my kids get to that point where they're doing a John Hughes thing, assuming that John Hughes is still a thing when my kids are teenagers.
Yeah, and you know, at some point after I finished film school and I was trying to decide whether I wanted to go back to grad school and, you know, what to do with this degree that wasn't really serving me the way that I had expected it to, I definitely considered going back and teaching. And that would have been something that, you know, it's probably a fantastic course to have in 2017 where you talk about John Hughes and how young people were represented in the 80s mm-hmm. and, you know, where are we now compared to that? So, I mean, it serves its purpose in a way where you can critically dissect it.
Yeah, and I also think, too, that one of the things that's interesting, not to interrupt, I'm sorry, but one thing that's interesting about critically, like, really taking a look at a movie like this is one of my favorite, like, YouTube reviewers is this girl, Lindsay Ellis, and she has a series ongoing right now called The Whole Plate, which is an examination of auteur theory using Michael Bay's Transformers movies. And she essentially says that, you know what, like, looking critically at these movies is something that's really lacking in the industry because whether or not you like them is not really material. And because people consider them low art, by and large, critics don't take them seriously beyond writing the review of the movie and then moving on with their life. And taking something that's a huge hit with the masses and kind of looking at it a little bit more deeply and contextualizing it has value, even if that thing is kind of low art. And I kind of feel like maybe that's, like, 16 Candles is the kind of movie that a lot of people will watch, they'll enjoy the jokes, and they'll give it a pass because, like, well, you know, they said fag 12 times, but it was 1986, you know?
Exactly.
So to me, like, I think that those are the kind of things that are worth at least occasionally actually stopping to examine, because I think that by and large, critical culture takes them at face value because they aren't meant to be analyzed. They're meant to be popcorn art.
I mean, and not, if nothing else, it holds a mirror up to what life was like at that time. And even though they're not, you know, like we were talking about, they are kind of like a caricature of that time. Mm-hmm. They are true to what was the norm and what was accepted. And, you know, the fact that kind of stuff did get a pass and no one was up in arms and it was a PG movie. And, you know, what steps have we taken forward and what steps have we taken back on? Because I do think that there's a lot of backsliding and there's a lot of, you know, people who are trying to go and lash out on PC culture and how, you know, you should be able to do this and you should be able to say this stuff. And I would not be surprised if in the next year, two, three, that kind of stuff resurfaces and we go and we see a blockbuster film in the theater that is going to do those kind of tropes and that kind of stuff, and it's going to be considered, you know, an edgy throwback.
Yeah.
I'm prepping myself for that because it's going to happen because that's where we are as a society right now. And we have to kind of be prepared on, as far as, like, especially you know, this is kind of your bread and butter. Like, how do we talk about that? How do we critique that when inevitably pops back up again?
Yeah, and that's really, like, it's funny because I made a joke. On Twitter, I found this, like, meme. It was 30 days of movies, and the idea was to get you coming back to engage with whatever company it was, put this on Twitter every day for a month. I just saved the image because I didn't have time to do that, but I ended up by making like a series of short videos for our Facebook page looking at, you know, what's your favorite this? What's the most overrated that? And, you know, when I was trying to name my favorite comedy, I was like, I'm a comedy guy. There's a lot of movies I could name. I'm going to make the tiebreaker The Great Dictator, primarily because in some weird-ass fucking way, we've become a culture where Nazis have a foothold again. And that's just weird to me. So, yeah, I'm going to go Chaplin on this one.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's like a rewatch or a reread of any kind of important text, you're doing it in the context of what's happening at that time. And yeah, so that Great Dictator is going to have, probably it's going to be on a lot of syllabuses and a lot of film schools.
Yeah.
More so than it has been in the last like 10 years or so.
Yeah. I think that the normalization of Nazi ideology combined with like the 14 million think pieces about the ways in which Trump's populist appeal mirrors Hitler's pretty much makes that kind of stuff inevitable. It's just like, yep, this is a thing that we're going to like. And on the other side of that, I suspect that liberals in Hollywood are going to gear themselves up for a 10-year run of Nazi punching movies, which have kind of fallen out of favor since Inglourious Bastards.
I definitely am interested. I mean, you've got a time in history where news, the idea of the news, has become so stratified, and, you know, it's since the dawn of cable, basically, you've got niche news, and it's so curated towards an ideology. And I almost look at Fox, and it's like the WWF of the 80s, where it's supposed to be real, but everyone knows it's not, but everyone ignores the fact that it's not because it's entertaining and it's what they want to hear. And so it's interesting that that's the idea of facts and journalism. And, you know, I'd love to get Zach in on this discussion because it's his, you know, daily fight, but it doesn't work. You know, you can't say, but this is the piece that I've spent countless weeks and months and hours investigating, meticulously researching and fact-checking, and it falls on deaf ears, but they still love to be entertained.
Yeah.
And so the way, like, my coworker and I were joking the other day about how the best way to get through to Trump is to create a fictional TV show that he's going to be really into and just feed him like little nuggets of like, and then the president does this and everyone loves him, and like get him to be like, oh yeah, I'm going to do that. And I'm going to take credit, because people listen to fiction. People care about fiction. Nonfiction to them is just, there's no objective consumption of it.
Right. Yeah. And that's, I mean, yeah, again, this is something we should probably do. Like, we should set up an episode that's specifically like, yeah, let's look at All the President's Men and Lord of War or something, and just like go to town on this topic, because we could go on like forever. But it's definitely pertinent to what we're looking at here. First of all, because, you know, we have River's Edge that's inspired by true events. But secondly, because like you said, everything, like when you're looking at something that's 35 years old, it's impossible not to look at it in the context of today. And I think that the like, well, we'll give it a pass because it was the 1980s instinct that I was talking about before, is there's definitely a time and a place for that. But I also think that it does a lot of things a disservice, because it's kind of like, well, then we're not having this conversation.
And, you know, those who forget history are damned to repeat it.
Yeah, and then those who repeat history are ultimately going to be the president, because he probably got a 62. All right. Well, I should probably wrap now because it's been about 2 hours.
Yeah, this has been really great.
Yeah, I've had a great time.
Thank you for inviting me to do this. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because like even with everybody who's usually on the show, and even with Erica to an extent because she does commercials and things now, there's like the, oh yes, find me on social media because I'm pimping things. As an attorney, I doubt that you have that element of your work. But is there anything that you would want to mention?
No, this is it. This has been my dipping of my toe into the water of film and television and theory. And I really enjoyed it. I hope I could be back on again. I've kind of been looking for an excuse to do something like this. And it was a real great experience. And I feel very lucky that, you asked me to do this particular episode, and I hope I get to do many more.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been great talking to you. And like I said, I'll put up a schedule for the rest of the Riverdale stuff now so that over the next, 12 weeks or whatever, anybody who wants to jump on board is more than welcome to. And hopefully we'll be able to get you and me and Erica all together one week.
That would be awesome.
All right. Thanks so much, Ava. I will talk to you soon. And thank you to anybody who's still listening.
Awesome. Thanks again. And thanks to everyone listening. It was a really awesome thing to be able to be a part of. And like I said, I hope I'm part of more.